Feeling 7 up, I'm feeling 7 up. It's a crisp, refreshing feeling, crystal clear and light. America's drinking 7 up, and it sure feels right. Feeling lucky 7.
Kevin, stop singing,
seven,
man.
Seven. Huh? What's a singing guy?
New York City, 1959. The battleground was rock and roll.
You're making them behave like a bunch of animals.
Oh, baby.
Give your clothes to Cheryl. You're never gonna stop rock and roll, don't you know that?
It was the beginning of an era. You should have been there. American Hot Wax, rated PG. Stop.
And I don't know.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around 10 o'clock tonight. Put your scratch backs on. Join me home, we'll have some fun. When the clock strikes one, we're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes two.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim, and today is our special rock and roll themed episode. We'll be talking about the new film, the biopic Rocket Man, and we're going to discuss the rock and roll biopic and I guess other musical biopics in general theme today. And of course, to help me in this endeavor, as always, he's been very busy keeping the skeletons at bay. It's Lindsey Graham's personal closet locksmith, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
I have no response to this one. That was just brilliant.
He's got to have a heavy lock on that door, because if those skeletons ever come flying out, I don't know.
It could be disastrous, or, you know, more likely nobody will care.
You know, I'm wondering, do you think that the Cato Institute offers classes to the GOP in hypocrisy? I'm guessing they do.
Yes, they do.
Because yeah. Lindsey Graham seems to have reversed everything he's ever said at the beginning of his political career. But anyways, we're on to other things. Music.
Yes.
And biopics. Hollywood loves to trot them out. Never-ending supply.
When do you think this genre started? Pretty early on, I would guess.
Way or like since the beginning of film, they were making, you know, musicals because, you know, think about it. Film kind of came after vaudeville. So vaudeville was the big entertainment and they started making movies about like famous vaudevillians. Right.
So, yeah, maybe the jazz singer.
Well, yeah, I mean, the jazz singer, that was the first sort of, most of it was silent, but there was the talking sequences. And Al Jolson came from vaudeville.
Yes, exactly.
And then they even made the Al Jolson story with Al Jolson.
With Al Jolson. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking. That may be one of the first, one of the earliest musical biopics.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot, but they had the Glenn Miller story.
Yeah.
Yankee Doodle Dandy, which was one of my favorites, was the George M. Cohan story.
That's right. Yes, I like that movie quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, and that's, of course, another vaudevillian who then went to Broadway and then, you know,
they
made a movie about him.
And those vaudevillian musicals tend to be a little different than the rock and roll pictures. They have a different ethos and spirit to them, I think.
You know, obviously rock and roll started in the late 50s and then throughout the 60s, so they really weren't making rock and roll biopics in the 60s of those rock and rollers. There were rock and rollers like Elvis who were in movies where he got to sing.
Right.
I
would classify Jailhouse Rock as one of the earliest rock and roll movies.
Yes, exactly. Let's kick it off with the latest, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
Rocket Man.
Yes, there's Rocket Man.
Directed by Dexter Fletcher.
Yeah, the pinch hitter.
Yes, for those who are scratching their heads, like, who's this Dexter Fletcher? Well, let me tell you, Dexter Fletcher's name wasn't on the directed by credits for Bohemian Rhapsody. But for those who don't know, when the original disgraced director, Bryan Singer,
himself out of a job.
Yes, he was fired several weeks before the completion of Bohemian Rhapsody. They brought in Dexter Fletcher to finish directing the movie. So I don't really give him necessarily the credit for the success or for the failure of the movie itself.
No, he was basically doing cleanup. He did, I would say, a competent job, probably the best he could under the circumstances.
Yeah, it's still not clear. I mean, and depending on the article you read, he either directed a couple of scenes or he may have ghost-directed a lot of scenes. No one really knows for sure.
Was he in the editing room?
I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, that could have been a thing where once the film was shot, the producers took it over. And
yeah.
There's just, again, it's one of those movies where maybe 10 years from now, there'll be a behind-the-scenes written about that film.
There should be.
But Dexter Fletcher is also an actor. I knew him.
He's a comedian, correct?
No. I don't know if he's a comedian. I mean, he was a serious actor. It's really funny. He popped up when I rewatched Band of Brothers. He was one of the men in the military, and he had an American accent. He's British. And he also, what I had noticed him before, he was in Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels. And when he was still like maybe only 19 or 20, he was in this movie called The Rachel Papers.
Oh, yes. Yes. I remember liking that movie. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
It's been a few years since I rewatched it. But, you know, he was the classic guy trying to get the girl who was way out of his league type of film.
Right.
But, you know, so he was an actor. And, you know, he still shows up from time to time in role, but he moved into directing, and he directed a film called Eddie the Eagle, right?
Yes.
And that, you know, I think that was what gave him enough directing cred that he was able to get the pinch-hitting job on Bohemian Rhapsody.
Have you seen Eddie the Eagle?
I haven't. I'd heard good things about it.
I've heard good things, too. I haven't seen it, but, it has a good reputation.
So, you know, I don't know if it was because he was able to go in, save the day on Bohemian Rhapsody, and kind of, I think he got a lot of respect from people in the industry, but he was tapped on the shoulder to direct the screen telling of Elton John's life in Rocket Man.
Yeah. Okay.
And so he's the director of that, and he's directed it from, you know, the whole way through. He was not a pinch hitter. He actually got to put his directorial stamp. And I have to be honest, because of my dislike for Bohemian Rhapsody, and also just watching the trailers for Rocket Man,
right?
I had zero interest in seeing this film.
I did not see any of the trailers.
Of course you didn't.
Of course I didn't. Of course I didn't see any of the trailers. I barely knew this movie existed until, you know, last week.
No, stop. You knew it was coming out. I know you. But I know what you mean. You really weren't, it wasn't something you were paying too much attention
to. Exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. And, but it's, you know, it's a movie that people have been talking about. I've talked to a few people who don't usually go to the movies who've seen it.
Okay.
Just because they kind of like the whole Elton John musical thing. I've talked to a few people who liked it who didn't like Bohemian Rhapsody.
So, but you like me, probably went to see this for one reason and one reason only.
Yes, same reason.
And that's because we have a podcast that we thought would be fun because we had talked for a long time about doing an episode on rock and roll biopics and other rock and roll type movies. And we thought, well, you know, how could we ignore the movie that's out right now in theaters?
Right. We can ignore Bohemian Rhapsody, but
we had already discussed that ad nauseum. So we don't need to discuss Bohemian Rhapsody, but I didn't think that was one of the more successful ones. So here we go. I saw Rocket Man a few days ago, and I went in. I wouldn't say, you know, I was kind of dreading it. You know, I know there was a lot of supposed to be a fantasy element to the movie that already sent concerns into my brain because it felt like it was sort of a magical realism. And that's really not my favorite approach to any kind of story. I just am not a magic realist guy. But I do like musicals, which is a fantasy element. Yes. And I didn't really know what I was getting. I didn't know it was, I thought it was going to be like a musical biopic, but then there was these fantasy elements. I didn't know it might even be a musical.
And it really is a musical.
And that's what I was surprised. So here it is, just cutting it to the chase. I found myself actually enjoying the movie Rocket Man.
I'm shocked.
I sat there, right? So the opening of the film, the first 30 seconds of the film, maybe the first minute.
Which is the shot of him walking down the hallway.
Yes, and he's in this wacky, outrageous costume.
Yes.
No, there's no context. And then, I don't think I'm giving it away because it's the framing device. He sits down and he's in a 12-step program group.
Yeah, like a group therapy session.
Yeah, but he's dressed in this ridiculous outfit, mm-hmm. and I immediately started to think of Malcolm Gladwell, the writer, and the mm-hmm. book Blink, and how you can sort of come up with a opinion within 30 seconds of something,
right.
and that if you have a negative reaction, you're probably going to stay negative. And I actually, like, Malcolm Gladwell stuck right into my head because I'm like, wow, we're a 1 minute in, and I hate this movie. I hate it. This movie is going to be terrible. But then something crazy happens. Like, literally 2 minutes later, and as it gets into the first sort of flashback into his life, I found myself enjoying the movie. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to take a step back here and go with it because there's some interesting things happening.
Some very interesting things.
The cinematography, for one, was much better than Bohemian Rhapsody. And I know we keep comparing it, but I feel like in the digital world, one of the things that really bothered me about Bohemian Rhapsody is I felt like from the lighting to the way the sets were, it felt like something that I was watching on TV, that really awful sort of stodgy digital look. And it didn't have a directorial vision. It just felt very lifeless. Whereas right from the get-go, I felt Rocket Man's got a style. Like, okay, this director has to be responsible for some of this, and he's actually got a point of view here.
Yeah.
And he's taking an approach that, for a story, I guess when we look at all of these musical biopics, everybody takes license with the truth to tell a story. But the way that this Rocket Man chose to go and tell Elton John's story as kind of a musical fantasy, it avoids all those other traps about, well, did it happen this way or did it happen that way?
It doesn't matter because it's almost like a fable about him.
Yeah, and it's almost kind of like from Elton's memories, which were foggy because he did so many drugs
exactly.
and alcohol.
The movie doesn't give you years or dates.
Yes.
which I like because it separates it from reality a little bit. It puts it into its own time frame, which is kind of from his point of view and his dislocation in time because of, well, you know, drugs and alcohol you know, an insane work schedule. But because it's separated from reality, I didn't really care about did it actually happen this way or is this being portrayed accurately, because it was getting at sort of an emotional truth to the story as opposed to the factual truth.
It pretty much told of a 13 to 15 year period was really the main crux of the story. And I was thinking the same thing. When you had a film like Bohemian Rhapsody, when they went to the trouble of actually putting like a date stamp on certain scenes, and then you know, if you know anything about the history of Queen, that didn't happen and couldn't have happened at that date, it really took me out of the film.
Exactly.
In the Rocket Man, just as you said, I was thinking that. I was like, you know, I don't know. I couldn't tell you exactly when this event happens, and the movie's not telling me exactly when it happens, and that's helpful.
And it's helpful, exactly. Well, and the other thing is that, you know, like in the Queen movie, there's some stuff about when songs came out and stuff like that. And this, not even an issue, because right from the beginning, you have the child Elton John singing Elton John songs.
I felt the second half, when he's sort of in his decline, it drags a little bit. It's just not as much fun as the first half.
It loses some steam, and the reason why, I think, is because the character loses motivation. So that first hour, when he's really trying to succeed and figure out who he is and develop that persona and that voice, that really gives him a lot of motive and goal. And it makes sense with the character, but the character kind of loses sight of the thread of what the story is. And so as a result, the story loses a little weight. It keeps coming back to this thing with his parents and his relationship with his parents, but it loses a little steam. And I think the other thing is, all these movies kind of have the same story, right?
You have the rise,
yes,
and then there's the downfall, and then you have to have the sort of coming out of that to be successful again. Unless, of course, it's one of those biopics where they die at the end.
Right, exactly. So there's The Doors.
Exactly. Where Jim Morrison dies at the end.
Where Jim Morrison dies at the end. And then there's, you know, Coal Miner's Daughter or something like that, where there's recovery at the end.
Yes, because she has a nervous breakdown.
Yes.
And then she, you know, recovers triumphantly. But, you know, so even though I didn't think that the second half was as successful as far as – it wasn't as entertaining.
Yeah.
And there is – you know, it is a little bit, as you described before, it was a little bit – not karaoke, but it was like the greatest hits of Elton John sprinkled through.
Yeah.
What they did do, though, it was cool. And again, I was actually even confused because I know that there's like they either had a stage version of Rocket Man or they're going to, but like
right.
It actually played out with a musical, with real musical choreographed numbers that were pretty good.
They were pretty good. Yeah, I could see
I
this.
Was entertained.
I could see it on stage. Well, yes. And no, there's actual choreographed musical numbers, which you don't usually have in a rock biopic.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, on paper, I had heard very briefly there was a scene where, you know, he's elated by the crowd and he starts floating and then
yeah.
And then the crowd starts floating. Well, it turns out it's sort of his first debut in America, and it's that feeling of electricity and excitement
yeah.
When, you know, when you've really hit, like, this is what you love to do. And when it plays out on screen, it really is magical. You actually
yes.
buy into this thing where this is how he felt performing for the crowd and how he was making the crowd feel.
Yeah, how the audience felt too. And they're sort of in this magical moment together with the performer and the audience, and it transcends. And they did that literally.
And that's where I think Dexter Fletcher is going to probably have a career making some films, probably going to get to make more of these biopics, because I think that he was able to direct these scenes in a way that they worked when they absolutely couldn't have, they shouldn't have worked,
right.
And in many cases wouldn't have worked, but he made them work.
Yeah, he did. He pulled it off.
Plus, I have to say, I mean, you know, this movie comes out, it's Pride Month, and what I felt is that, again, we keep comparing it to Bohemian Rhapsody, but there's some very similar stories.
Very similar stories, yeah.
Two men that had to kind of live sort of quasi-closeted lives, Freddie Mercury more so than Elton
yeah.
John. But where this film is much more successful is I walked away really feeling like the motivation for why Elton John or the character went off the deep end. It really makes a strong point is that he was a man who he just craved being loved by somebody.
But yes.
Because of his family. And because he had to be closeted, he couldn't be who he wanted to be in public. And what he got to see other people around him enjoying his success, but by that success, they got to be loved
right.
in an outward fashion that he had to keep private. And I thought it was actually very powerful. Like, there was a message to the movie about the need for anybody to just be allowed to love and be loved.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds corny.
Well,
I actually got that message from the movie.
But that's actually the message. And the thing is that as a message for a musical is great. That's a great message for a musical. You know, it doesn't have to be so deep and psychologically complex as you would in, you know, a standard drama. You can paint with broader strokes in a musical. And so, like, the group therapy session, which is the framing device for the whole thing, is not necessarily totally realistic.
No, because those people didn't even look like they were from whatever the time period they should have been.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's more like it's almost like it's taking place inside his head, this therapy session. Yes.
But they also found a way, and like I said, this is where I judged it too quickly. I was amazed when it happened. I didn't see it coming. They found a way to tie in everything that was happening in those first couple of minutes. It made sense by the end of the movie.
Yes, it made sense by the end of the movie. So here's my one complaint about this movie.
Okay.
And...
Well, did you like the movie? I think it sounds like you did.
Oh, yes, I did like the movie. I didn't love the movie, but I liked the movie. I totally enjoyed watching it. I would recommend it to people. It's just not a masterpiece, but that's fine.
Yeah, I strongly liked it, and I am recommending it for people, especially anybody that I know that if they enjoyed Bohemian Rhapsody, well, give this thing a shot because it's way better.
Well, and one movie that we've talked about before that this really reminded me of a lot, or at least the first half reminded me of a lot, was Sing Street.
The first half does have a little bit of a Sing Street vibe to it.
Yes. The kid Elton John is similar to the kid just in terms of how he gets into different styles. And there's, you know, the part where Elton John and Bernie Taupin are writing in the mom's house. There's similar scenes like that in Sing Street.
And you know what's funny? That must be the stuff that I just gravitate to in these movies because that is some of the stuff I liked the most.
Yeah.
I kind of liked... Again, I don't know how realistic it was, but I loved how he and Bernie Taupin got put together.
Yes, and that was a little bit of a fantasy moment, but the film actually said, like, he's handed the envelope, and it goes into, like, this freeze frame, kind of magical moment. And,
yeah.
And so it's sort of acknowledging that maybe this isn't, you know... He wasn't just handed the perfect envelope that day. Maybe he had to go through a few, but the way it's remembered is as this magical moment.
Yeah, and that's another thing, too, when people think about, like, what is their memories. And I think it helps knowing that Elton John was heavily involved in this story and he wasn't already passed away because you know that whatever's real or not, it had Elton's approval.
Right.
Whereas in Bohemian Rhapsody... It had the band's approval, but it didn't have Freddie Mercury's. And they told a sanitized version, whereas Elton John, and this is, again, while it wasn't as much fun in the second half, what I really respected was it basically said that Elton John became an egomaniac.
Yes.
He was basically just drugs and alcohol. And they really handled something that I never have seen in a movie handled well before. Basically... And I think this also contributes to that time jumping or we're not sure what time it is.
Right.
They actually show him, he's basically having blackouts.
Yes.
And they don't actually go, you're having blackouts. It's just, use your imagination, audiences. There's a moment where like Bernie Taupin's trying to talk to him and he realizes that he has no idea how much time has passed. And
right. There's
another time when he wakes up and he had been like asleep for a couple of days. And this is exactly what happens to people when they have blackouts.
Yeah.
They function, and then one day they're like, wait, what happened in the last couple of days?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to spoil too much of the movie. Let me get back to my complaint about this movie.
Oh, yeah. You have a complaint.
I have a complaint about this movie, and it's a little hard to escape for the movie, but basically it's as we talked about, it's the rise to fame, it's the addiction, and then at the end there has to be recovery, right? And... So at the end of the movie, there's the recovery. He has a nice scene with Bernie. They do the group therapy thing. And then it comes up on the screen. Elton John has been sober for 28 years.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I thought this is where you're going to go. And after you finish, I have a thought on it.
Okay. And so it's a little like the story to tell is where all the drama is, right? And then as soon as you're sober, your life's kind of over. It's like, okay, did group therapy, stopped drinking, no more story to tell for Elton John. But the fact is, there's a lot more story to tell. You know, I was like, how far are they going to go with this? Are they going to have, like, Elton John and Eminem at the Grammys? Like,
well, I mean, I think that's the whole point is that there's a lot of his life. All his big hit years, I mean, you know, there was a lot of other things he did do, but... What I got out of it is if you look at the timeline, I mean, yeah. there's that I'm Still Standing. Now, we all know, and even I knew as a kid at that point when that song came out, because Casey Kasem on the America's Top right. 40, he told Elton John took a little time off, and now he's still standing. Is that that was the early 80s. Now, I do know that he had a bad alcohol and coke problem. But when they say that 28 years, now we've moved up into like, what, 1990, 91.
Yeah.
So it tells me that even though he had his major recovery, there was probably still several years where he wasn't still, you know, it takes a while. It doesn't, yeah. you don't get that one recovery moment. So I actually kind of liked it that it's like, okay, he did have a comeback, but he may have had more years where he still had to sort things out.
Right. Yeah. It just felt a little abrupt to me and almost like, I didn't really feel that, but it almost by focusing on that part of his life, the second hour of the movie almost glamorizes that kind of drugs and alcohol rock star lifestyle.
Well, I mean, he even says it in the movie, but if you talk to Elton John, he enjoyed a lot of those years.
Oh, yes, he does say that in the movie. Yeah, you're right. He says, I had a great time. I enjoyed loved every minute of it or something. But
I'm okay that they didn't, you know, I mean, again, I mean, look, we go back to Bohemian Rhapsody. They decided to end on this like triumphant high.
Yeah.
But they also decided to mix in that he had AIDS when he didn't have AIDS at that point in time.
Right.
and so, you know, they condensed the story a different way. But so I really, that wasn't bothered me. But again, if that's your one complaint, I think what I'm hearing you say and what I'm saying is that shock among shocks, we are recommending this movie to people.
Yes, we are recommending this. Okay, I'll recommend it. Yeah.
You can recommend it. It's okay to say, like, it doesn't mean you're going to go watching it again. You're not going to buy it when it comes out on video. You liked it and you enjoyed it. And
one other thing about this movie to recommend it is the lead performance is great.
I know. And I had already had a thing where I'm not a fan of those Kingsman movies. So Taron Egerton, I really was kind of against, but he really threw everything he had yeah. into the movie. And I will tell you this too. One thing that I like I like biopics where even if they don't sound 100% like the artist, where they do their own singing versus yeah. the dubbing, because it adds an authenticity to the performance and you're suddenly sucked in a little bit more of a real way.
Well, and there really wasn't another way to do this because a lot of the songs had to be arranged differently so they could be used in the film. They're not.
Does that stop Hollywood? It never stops them.
No, it never stops them. But yeah, but you know, in terms of lip syncing, like the songs are different in the movie than they are on the album.
And that's why, again, where I liked it is that you probably had Elton John playing the piano because it had yes. that Elton John sound. But he was smart enough to say, you know what? I mean, I guess Taron, he's a singer. He actually yeah. sings. Again, even though it didn't, like, I never for once said, oh, my God, he sounds exactly like Elton. He sounded enough like Elton.
Exactly.
And more importantly, again, it sounded like the voice that was coming out of the voice that was talking in the movie.
Exactly.
And so instead of being taken out, I got taken out with Bohemian Rhapsody where, yeah, that sounded like him doing a great lip sync job to Freddie Mercury.
And that's about all it sounds like. Yeah. And this, he's actually singing, and everyone else in the movie is actually singing too.
Yeah. I loved that part. I mean, again, there was moments, right? There was a chunk of the film. I think we talked about it, that Rise part that for a yeah. while there, I'm like, I can't believe it. I love this movie.
Yeah.
And eventually it came back to earth to me a little bit, but I still liked it a lot more than most biopics I've seen in recent years. So
yeah. And another one that this reminds me of just because of doing their own singing is the Buddy Holly story.
Yeah. And that's one of the standards though. I was a kid, I didn't know Buddy Holly, so I don't know all the details. I've heard that takes a lot of liberties too, but I think that's a really good biopic.
Yeah, and Gary Busey does sing and play the guitar himself.
Yeah, he was nominated for an Oscar for that, and he really is good. And he actually sounds a lot like Buddy Holly.
And that is a hard voice to do.
Yeah, he actually has a vocal defect like Buddy Holly did, which allowed him to do those uh-ohs Buddy Holly could do.
The epiglottal flip.
Yeah, yeah, he actually had that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, Gary Busey was in, he was like in various rock groups, right, in the 70s. Okay. And that's how he got the job is because he could actually play the guitar and he could sing.
Okay, yeah, so that, because of that, and I know other reasons too, but I really like the Buddy Holly story. Yes, it probably takes liberties. Yes, again, these all follow the same story.
Another film where this person sings the songs, you mentioned it at the beginning, is Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yes.
That's actually one of my favorite of the biopics because it actually has sort of a documentary feel.
Yeah, it's very raw and real and plays like a drama more than a music film.
It's just the way it's done in a very low-key style is very interesting. And again, yeah, when you sing the songs and it doesn't sound like a recording, because back then, I mean, I think with Bohemian Rhapsody, they were able to mix a combination of Freddie Mercury's voice with Rami Malek's. And, you know, so computers can do a lot. But back then, you either had the songs that were at, you know, the studio recordings that you dubbed over and with your lips, or you sang. That was it.
Yeah.
And so it either sounded ridiculous or, you know, authentic. Another one that is one of my favorites. I think it's one of your favorites, too. And this is one where there actually is the original artist's voice, though there's enough moments of the performer doing the voice just to kind of bridge you in.
Right.
But it's such a dynamic performance and the storytelling is really well done. And it's another one of those things where when the ads came out, both you and I think thought, no way. But then it started to get some advanced word that it was really good. And this is early 90s. And you and I were both living in LA that you were just getting ready to leave with like in a couple of weeks. And the movie was What's Love Got to Do with It?
Yep. I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
You and I decided we're going to go see this and we're going to see it opening day and we're going to go see it up the street from where you were living.
Yes.
Which was the Cinerama Dome.
Yep.
In Hollywood. And so we go to the very first show. It was like a noon show.
Yeah.
At the legendary Cinerama. And I think the both of us thought, you know, this isn't going to be a big film and it's not going to be a very kind of packed crowd or anything.
No,
we're
just
going to kind of step in.
It was something to see and it was what was out that week. It wasn't, you know, something we'd been waiting months for.
No, like I said, they showed ads and it looked a little like cheesy because I think they played it heavily on the What's Love Got to Do with It song, which is just, you know. But again, the reviews were like already out of sight. And I was shocked by that. I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is going to be good. It looked a little cheesy, but okay. So we go there. And much to our surprise, it's completely packed.
Yes.
Super packed with people. So there's this energy that you and I were not expecting.
Right. Yeah, you know, yeah. And
we're like, what's going on here? People seem to know something we don't know. And, you know, of course, back then, the Cinerama Dome, you know, it really had some of the best sound system.
Oh, yeah. I remember that just being loud and, you know, loud and clear.
If a movie was in 70 millimeter, it would show there a lot of times. This was not a 70 millimeter showing, but I mean, it had whatever the THX sound.
It had whatever the best sound was at that time.
You know, this movie gets going. Before long, once Tina Turner is starting to really do her thing on screen, which was Angela Bassett played her, something happened that I had not ever seen happen in a movie before. And I think this was one of those cases where like the Cinerama Dome had several rows that were ground level and then it kind of rose in like an auditorium style seating. And we were in the auditorium style seating, but like so right below us, people, and not just like one or two, but dozens and dozens of people, probably very devoted Tina Turner fans, were getting up and dancing and going wild. And it really took on a concert experience, and the sound coming out of the speakers enhanced that, and you started to feel like you were at a concert.
Well, and the sheer force of her performance, too. It is...
It was electric.
Yes, it was electric. And the audience took off with that electricity. And yeah, you're right. It was sort of a concert type environment, but it's rare that you get that kind of electricity in a movie theater. And it really happened with that movie. People were, yeah. And I walked out of there thinking, that is a great movie.
We were very energized when it was over. But yeah. I remember that, you know, there are some really tough scenes in there.
Yeah, some with the Ike Turner abusing her.
When the moment when she hits Ike back, that entire audience exploded.
Yes.
People were going nuts. Like, you got it! Like, people were out. It was just, there was so much energy happening at that theater that was, again, it's that whole cinema-going experience that I just will never trade, you know, in for just my home screen. Because sometimes you get that one film where an audience is really tuned in and they just go apeshit. And that was one of those movies.
That did not happen to me in Rocket Man, where I was the youngest person by 125 years.
Oh, you stole my joke. I saw it. I texted you, but you just added about 100 years to it.
I stole your joke, but you told me that you were the youngest person in the theater. I went the next day to see it, and I was the youngest person in the theater.
It's true. I think I had the darkest hair color.
I think I had the exact same experience as you. I mean, sure, a weekday matinee, you're going to get more retirees, but...
Yeah, I mean, but of course, you know, Elton John, is he like 70, 71?
He's 72.
Yeah, so I mean, his fan base is, that's, you know...
Yeah. So one thing I was thinking about with the Rocket Man movie is it is a traditional biopic, but it's also kind of a rock and roll movie. And there's a whole subgenre of movies that are like rock and roll or music movies, not musicals. I guess they're post rock and roll movies. They happen after the invention of rock and roll. And they're movies that are sort of have the spirit of rock and roll or are about the music, but they're not a biopic. They're not necessarily about the musician.
Right.
And so, okay, like the easiest one probably to put on this list would be School of Rock.
Somewhat of a making a band movie, but it's just, it's the spirit of rock. That guy, he loves rock and roll. He wants to be involved. He's like not in a successful band. And the thing that upsets him most is just that he doesn't get to be part of the band, right?
Exactly, yeah.
He loves rock and roll.
He loves rock and roll, and he brings the spirit of rock and roll to these kids. And they sort of break out of their shells because of it. And I think, yeah, so it's like, what is the spirit of rock and roll? It's this kind of rebellious, anarchic, go all out, live life to the fullest. You know, Sing Street, we were talking about, is one of those movies where...
Yeah, I mean, it's a making of the band movie. That's a different subgenre. But at the same time, it's the spirit of rock and roll. That's why... It catches on.
Exactly. Know? It's the spirit of rock and roll. Yeah, and it is a making the band movie. Okay, a movie that's not a making the band movie.
Okay.
This is probably the purest rock and roll movie that's not about musicians in the same way is Streets of Fire.
It's a rock and roll fable.
It's a rock and roll fable. Exactly.
Your history with this film has to be the same as mine because when it came out in the theaters, It was marketed horribly.
Yes.
And I remember with my, you know, $4 or whatever it cost me to go as a kid, and I have to plunk it down, and so I get to make my choice of film. When it came out, I remember, what year was it, 84?
I'll look it up.
Or is it 85? Because you got to get me the year on that, all right?
So, okay.
Because I need to tie it to that year.
84.
It's 84. So the summer of 84... I think I now remember it. My dad took me to the theater. I desperately wanted to see the sneak preview of Ghostbusters.
Of course.
All right. And now the theater had all whatever else was playing, right? I thought, you know, my dad had taken me to sneak previews many times. They don't really do those anymore, but back then, you know, they would release it a week or two. And we get there and every movie was sold out. Right. Ghostbusters. Right. It was like an hour or we got there really early, too. And it was all sold out. And I was all crushed. So, you know, the logical thing was, well, what else could we see? There was only one movie playing that had seats. And that was Streets of Fire. And I was like, no way. Don't want to see it. My dad didn't want to see it. And you know, a movie is bad when it's the only film in the entire theater that's not sold out. and you still don't want to see it, even though you're there and you can see a film. And so we left not seeing it. And the movie only played for maybe 1 week at the local theater. So fast forward almost a year later, HBO, summer, watching Streets of Fire comes on. And it's just one of those movies that Michael Paré did, just like Eddie and the Cruisers, where it bombs in the theater, but you watch it like 1,000 times on HBO, and it's like really an entertaining movie.
Yeah, and you mentioned Eddie and the Cruisers. That was a movie that was in heavy rotation at the video store I worked at.
Yep. And Eddie and the Cruisers, coast to coast. And I ain't just talking Jersey.
Joe Pantoliano.
Yes. I've even seen the sequel to Eddie and the Cruisers, Eddie Lives.
Terrible. Yes, I saw that too, and that was really terrible. But the first one, Eddie and the Cruisers is a good, again, it's sort of about the musicians, where Streets of Fire is a little different.
Yeah, Streets of Fire, it's a rock and roll fable. How pretentious is that? And it's, you know, it's this crazy idea that it's kind of takes place in a different universe.
Right.
In a different time. It's a time of rock and roll, but it's sort of modern. And so it's like a mixture of 80s neon and 1950s greaser. And it is cool looking. Like, it's really cool. And it has the kind of the first time I ever noticed a performance by Willem Dafoe.
Oh, yes, that's right, yep.
And
he's really creepy. He's really creepy.
Of course, then it had, at the time, you know, she was kind of the bombshell.
Diane Lane,
and she plays Ellen Aim, head of Ellen Aim and the Attackers.
Yes.
and, of course, she had just a couple of years before, she had done another film that was like nobody had seen, and it's got more of a cult status now, where she plays another rock and roller, and that is, ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that not that long ago on the show.
Well, it was one of those band ones. That is a very hard to find movie, but it's definitely worth it, especially if you love this genre of films that I really like. The Fabulous Stains reminds me of another film that we've mentioned before, and it's another rock and roll, sort of more in the vibe than necessarily a rock and roll film, is Times Square.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've not seen it.
And I mention that because that's also notoriously hard to find.
Yeah.
And it's directed by somebody who's only made a few films, and none of them have ever really achieved great critical success, but they all have rock and roll tie-ins. The same director as Times Square directed Empire Records, which is famous for Rex Manning Day, and there's a lot of fans, my wife is one of them, of that movie, and a film that was important to me at the time. I think it was like my early college career. And I think I made you see it. And I don't know if you liked it as much. And it probably doesn't hold up today. But I mean, I loved it at the time, was Pump Up the Volume.
Yes. And that's definitely on my list of rock and roll movies. I haven't seen it since it came out. But I did like it.
Yeah. It's got, Christian Slater. And he plays sort of a pirate radio DJ.
Yeah, and that is a movie, again, about how, like, rock and roll gets into your soul and takes on the establishment.
Talk about subgenre within a subgenre, the idea of the DJ.
Yes.
And then, of course, if we want to get into more of the historical film that covers a DJ is American Hot Wax, which is from the late 70s. And I think it's probably because of music rights that they don't have the ability to put it on, Blu-ray or anything now.
Oh, okay.
Because there was tons of songs and they probably just didn't negotiate. But that came out in the late 70s. And it used to be on HBO all the time when I was a kid. And it tells the Alan Freed story.
Right.
The guy who basically, takes credit anyway for making rock and roll music popular with the white kids.
Right.
It was already popular with the African-American crowd, but not with the white kids. He made it okay. He made it safe for the white kids.
So you were talking about Alan Moyle.
That's right. That's the director of Pump Up the Volume.
Yes. And Empire Times Records. Square,
and Empire Records.
Yeah.
Rex Manning Day.
Which is, another Empire Records is another rock and roll movie that's sort of maybe in the same vein as like High Fidelity.
If we want to jump from genre to genre, Empire Records, then you next logically jump to High Fidelity, the record store movie.
Record store movies.
Which, you know, what's funny is High Fidelity actually features, I don't know if you knew him, I think you know him, was this actor Todd Loiseau.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if you knew him outside of school, but I went to NYU with him 1 year. Yeah. He was in my sound class, but he was also a working actor, so sometimes he would have to go off onto film sets for, you know, definite periods of time.
Yeah.
But, you know, he has a great role as one of the
music employees. Yeah.
Yeah. He's great.
Yeah. And that's definitely, yeah, that's a movie that's about the spirit of rock and roll.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the obsession.
It's the obsession.
With loving rock and roll music.
Yeah.
And of course, we say rock and roll, a lot of different genres, but, you know.
Sure, but there's a difference in movies that are in the rock era versus, like, the big band era. Or
yes.
The musical era, the show tune era. Okay, here's another one that I know you love, and I think of it as a rock and roll movie, is Repo Man.
You're, like, suddenly hitting my brain at the exact same points, but I'm going to say that... Obviously, it's not a musical. It's not about rock and roll, but there's an attitude. It's really about punk rock.
Yeah.
And the punk rock music, which really at the time had not been used in an effective way.
Right.
Repo Man was not a financial success. Very few theaters. As a matter of fact, it was really dumped. The studio only kept it out there in a couple of theaters because the soundtrack started doing well.
Yes.
And so in order to promote the soundtrack and make sure that people knew that a soundtrack existed, they put it out in theaters. And I'm one of the few people, I'm not bragging, but I'm just telling you the truth, is that the summer of 84, and I grew up in the Boston area, so we had access to a lot of films a lot of other people didn't have. The Nickelodeon Theater in Boston, they were showing Repo Man. And a few weeks before it came out, my mom and I went into town, and she took me to see a foreign film was really funny. And they showed a preview for this movie, Repo Man. And it looked totally bizarre and weird. And so both of us thought we should see that when it comes out in a couple of weeks. So when it came out in the theaters or to Nickelodeon, we went and saw it. And it, more than any movie probably in the 80s, had a huge cultural impact on me.
Yes, and on a lot of people.
I bought the record. I mean, I was not a punk, but I think that I really wanted to be.
Right.
But I didn't have, like, even the guts, you know, to dress like that. I was very shy and outgoing, but I think that that's what I wanted to. And I actually modeled my hair after Emilio Estevez's character.
Okay.
I got a flat top so that I could be as close to the haircut that he had. And I was really one of the only kids at school that had that haircut. And it's just, you know, because I wanted to identify with that character.
Yeah.
I loved everything about Repo Man. And there must have been something about it in Boston, because while it had long gone from any theater it ever played in, it played in Boston theaters for over a year.
That is fascinating.
It's just one of those. Remember, the video had not really hit its stride yet.
Yes. Yeah, so my introduction to Repo Man was on video.
Of course, because that's how I ended up seeing that more than any other movie. Like, I kept on renting it.
Yes. And it was one of those things where I had a friend who was into movies, and he turned me onto it, along with another movie. It's not a rock and roll movie, but it was the same day that he showed me Repo Man and Taxi Driver.
I don't know if it's a necessarily related combo, but I'm going to go with it. Sure.
It's not a related combo, but yeah, no, I just, that's my memory of Repo Man, is it was like hanging around this guy's house one Sunday afternoon, and he's like, oh, you got to see this.
The 80s, right, with Repo Man, suddenly, you know, you had this documentary filmmaker, Penelope Spheeris.
Yeah.
She comes out with The Decline of Western Civilization.
Yes.
And it is, and I didn't see that for years, but it was, you know, this film that documented the LA punk scene.
Yeah.
And that had never been, you know, like, that was not, it was a much different type of documentary on music that had ever existed before.
But it had that
attitude, where she then, her first feature film, this low budget movie that you turned me on to before we even started the podcast, was Suburbia.
Yes.
And I'm mentioning that because they're going to do a Penelope Spheris retrospective on Criterion this month.
Okay.
And so you can see the decline of the Western Civilization movies and also Suburbia, which I'm hoping will be a much better print than when I watched it on Amazon, like, you know, a year ago.
Right. Yeah. And it's, that is a really interesting low budget look at punk life in Los Angeles in the 80s. And it definitely is. It's a rock and roll movie in terms of its spirit and energy and, you know, taking on the man kind of thing.
Everybody knows these titles, but they may not have actually seen them.
Right.
One, Rock and Roll High School.
Absolutely.
Ramones. Right. That's a classic rock and roll film. And it's a musical. It's a rock and roll film. It's the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Okay. Yes. And Rocky Horror Picture Show is a rock and roll movie all the way.
It is all the way. I mean, it was designed as a sort of send-up tribute. Rocky Horror Picture Show was a review. It was a stage musical first,
yeah.
And it was really because of the love of like B movies from the 50s and the rock and roll music. Here's my question, because I think I don't know about today's generations of kids. Maybe it's just not a thing anymore. But you know, we grew up in the prime time. For the Rocky Horror Picture Show cinema experience.
Yes. Video, I think, home video basically killed the Rocky Horror cinema experience.
I'm guessing you saw it in the theater.
What, Rocky Horror?
Yeah, yeah.
More than once.
Okay, yeah. Well, me too. But my question is to you, because you're like, you know, here you are. You were in New Hampshire as a kid. Right. And you weren't like in like, you know, the main part of New Hampshire. You were like out in the woods a bit.
I was out in the woods a bit. So there was this theater in the Colonial Theater in Keene, New Hampshire.
OK.
An old style movie house, single screen. And it was run by this really interesting guy. I was thinking about him the other day. His name was Russ. I can't remember his last name, but he was the manager of this theater. And I used to hang out with him sometimes and, you know, just talk about movies and stuff. And he turned this theater into, you know, he would show movies during the regular times, but he would also have some concerts and stuff. And he decided to just play Rocky Horror every Saturday at midnight.
So how old were you when you first went?
So I was probably 13.
13, wow. So how did you get to see it at midnight? You're at 13. Who takes you?
I went with like a whole huge group of friends. Wow. And yeah, I went with probably 15 or 20 friends. So he played it like every Saturday for about a year. And by, you know, after a year, the attendance was way down.
Really?
But those first few showings were fantastic and filled with people who knew what they were doing. And so I definitely, I had the Rocky Horror experience.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to this episode of Stuff We've Seen. Hope you are enjoying our discussion on rock and roll movies and the musical biopic. There's just too many films to discuss for one episode, so come back in a few days and we'll have part two. We'll pick it right back up and you'll hear my experiences with seeing the Rocky Horror Picture Show and a whole bunch more. Now, if you've been enjoying the program, please tell friends to take a listen and certainly subscribe to us for free at iTunes so you don't miss any episodes, or check in on our website at stuffweveseen.com. And, you know, look for us on Twitter or at Instagram. And then you can always send us a message at feedback@jimandteal.com. All right, we'll see you in a couple days with the next episode, part two.